Hi, I'm Kathleen Wells, political correspondent for Race Talk. I'm speaking with Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and renowned political activist and writer. He has written over 100 books on linguistics, human rights, economics, and politics. Thank you, Professor Chomsky, for taking the time to speak with me this afternoon.
Very pleased to be with you.
Speak to me about the relation between the United States and Israel, specifically address, as you have previously stated, how every crime, violation of international law that Israel commits is done through the direct participation and authorization of the United States.
As a descriptive statement, pretty close to accurate. I mean, you know, all is a very strong word, but it's certainly generally true. And in fact, the United States has overwhelmingly vetoed Security Council resolutions condemning Israeli crimes and atrocities, prevented the Security Council from calling on Israel to terminate aggression, and so on and so forth. The descriptive comment is not really controversial. There are interesting questions about why it's true. There are also interesting questions about the sources of support for this position in the United States, which helps us explain why it's true. The history is reasonably clear. This was not the case up until 1967. In fact, before 1967, the relationships were not very different from relationships among other powers. There was sympathy and support for Israel, which has many, many sources, including the Christian Zionism, which is a very powerful force. It precedes and is numerically far stronger than Jewish Zionism. But for somebody like, say, Harry Truman, raised in a deeply Christian tradition, it was just taken for granted that the Bible instructs us that God gave the land of Palestine to the Jews. So it's kind of like in his bones. And that's true for a very large part of the American population, much more so than, far more than any other country. So that's one factor, and there are other factors. But the major change in relationships took place in 1967. Just take a look at U.S. aid to Israel, and you can tell that right off. And in many other respects, it's true, too. Similarly, the attitude towards Israel on the part of the intellectual community, you know, media, commentary, journals, and so on, that changed very sharply in 1967 from for either lack of interest or sometimes even disdain to almost passionate support. So what happened in 1967? Well, in 1967, Israel destroyed the source of secular Arab nationalism, Nasser's Egypt, which was considered a major threat and enemy by the West. It's worth remembering that there was a serious conflict at the time between the forces of radical Islamic fundamentalism centered in Saudi Arabia, where all the oil is, and secular Arab nationalism centered in Nasser's Egypt. In fact, the two countries were at war. They were fighting a kind of a proxy war in the Yemen at the time. The United States was, and Britain were supporting radical Islamic fundamentalism. In fact, they've rather consistently done that, supporting Saudi Arabia. And Nasserite secular nationalism was considered a serious threat because it was recognized that it might seek to take control of the immense resources of the region and use them for regional interests, rather than allow them to be essentially controlled and exploited by the United States and its allies. So that was a major issue. Well, Israel effectively destroyed Nasserite secular nationalism and the whole Arab nationalist movement that was centered in it. That was considered a major contribution to U.S. geopolitical strategy and also to its Saudi Arabian ally. And in fact, that's when attitudes towards Israel changed sharply, and U.S. support for Israel, material, diplomatic, and other, also increased sharply. In 1970, there was another turning point. That in 1970, the Jordanian army, Jordan was a strong, a close U.S. ally. The Jordanian dictatorship was essentially massacring Palestinians during what's the month that's called Black September. And the U.S. was in favor of that, supported that. It looked as though Syria might intervene to support the Palestinians against the attack by the Hashemite dictatorship. The U.S. didn't want that to happen. It regarded it as a threat to the to its Jordanian ally and also a broader threat ultimately to Saudi Arabia, the jewel in the crown. Well, the U.S. was mired in Southeast Asia at the time. That was right at the time, of the, a little after the Cambodian invasion. Everything was blowing up. The U.S. couldn't do a thing about it. So it asked Israel to mobilize its very substantial military forces and threaten Syria so that Syria would withdraw. Well, Israel did it. Syria withdrew. That was another gift to U.S. power, and in fact, U.S. aid to Israel was shot up very sharply, maybe quadrupled or something like that, right at that time. Now, at that time, that was the time when the Nixon, so-called Nixon Doctrine, was formulated. Part of the Nixon Doctrine was that the U.S., of course, has to control Middle East oil resources. That goes much farther back. But it will do so through local regional allies, what were called cops on the beat by the by Melvin Laird, Secretary of Defense. So there will be local cops on the beat, which will protect the Arab dictatorships from their own populations or any external threat. And, of course, police headquarters is in Washington. Well, the local cops on the beat at the time were Iran, then under the Shah, U.S. ally, Turkey, to an extent Pakistan, and Israel was added to that group. It was another cop on the beat. It was one of the local gendarmes that was sometimes called the periphery strategy, non-Arab states protecting the Arab dictatorships from any threat, primarily the threat of what was called radical nationalism, independent nationalism, meaning taking over their own resources for their own purposes. Well, that structure remained through the 1970s. In 1979, Iran was lost because of the overthrow of the Shah and the pretty soon the Khomeini dictatorship, clerical dictatorship. The U.S. once tried to overthrow that and supported Iraq's invasion of Iran and so on. But anyway, that cop was lost, and Israel's position became even stronger in the structure that remained. Furthermore, by that time, Israel was performing secondary services to the United States elsewhere in the world. It's worth recalling that especially through the 80s, Congress, under public pressure, was imposing constraints on Reagan's support for vicious and brutal dictatorships. Governments around the world, say Guatemala, the U.S. could not provide direct aid to Guatemala because of which was massacring people in some areas in genocidal fashion up in the highlands. Congress blocked it. The Congress was also passing sanctions against aid to South Africa, which the Reagan administration was strongly supporting. South Africa continued to do so right through the 1980s. This was under the framework of the war on terror that Reagan had declared. The African National Congress Mandela's ANC was designated as one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world as late as 1988. But to support South African apartheid and the Guatemalan murderous dictatorship and other murderous regimes, Reagan needed a kind of a network of terrorist states to help out to evade the congressional and other limitations. And he turned to, at that time, Taiwan, but in particular Israel. Britain helped out. And that was another major service, and so it continued.
I want to come up to today because I only have 30 minutes.
It basically continues. I mean, if we go right up till this moment,
exactly.
Simply ask, where are the strongest sources of support for Israeli actions? Well, take the newspapers. By far the most rabid pro-Israel newspaper in the country is the Wall Street Journal. That's the journal of the business community.
Mm-hmm.
And it reflects the support of the business world for Israel, which is quite strong. There is a lot of high-tech investment in Israel. Military industry is very close to Israeli military industry. There's a whole network of interactions. Intel, for example, is building its next facility for development of the next generation of chips in Israel. But altogether, the relations are very, very tight, very intimate, quite natural. Mm-hmm. And it's, it's not surprising that the main business journal in the country would be supporting Israeli expansion and power. Take a look at the two political parties. Most Jewish money goes to Democrats, and most Jews vote Democratic, but the Republican Party is much more strongly supportive of Israeli power and atrocities than the Democrats are. And again, that, I think, reflects their closer relations to the business world and to the military system. There's, of course, also a Jewish lobby, an Israeli lobby, AIPAC, which is a very influential lobby. So there are many, and there's Christian Zionism, which is a huge element. All of these combine to provide a background for U.S. support for Israel, and they're facing virtually no opposition. Mm-hmm. Who's calling for support of the Palestinians?
Exactly. And so when you hear statements being made that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and yet you see the occupation and the blockade on Gaza, the occupation of East Jerusalem and the West Bank, what shall one think about this fact?
Well, first let's ask about being the only democracy in the region.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
There were free elections in Palestine. In January 2006, there were free elections in Palestine, carefully monitored, recognized to be free. The victor was Hamas, okay, centered in the Gaza Strip. Israel and the United States instantly, within days, undertook perfectly public policies to try to punish the Palestinians for voting the wrong way in a free election. I mean, you couldn't see a more dramatic illustration of hatred and contempt for democracy, unless it comes out the right way. A year later, July 2007, the U.S. and Israel, together with the Palestinian Authority, tried to carry out a military coup to overthrow the elected government. Well, it failed. Hamas won and drove Fatah out of the Gaza Strip. Now, here, that's described as a demonstration of, Hamas terror or something. What they did was preempt and block a U.S.-backed military coup to overthrow the democratically elected government.
What do you say to the fact that Hamas is listed on the United States State Department terrorist list? So they're characterized as terrorists.
Yeah, they are, because they do things we don't like. I mean, the terrorist list has been a historic joke, in fact, a sick joke. So take a look at the history of the terrorist list. Up until 1982, Iraq, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, was on the terrorist list. In 1982, the Reagan administration removed Iraq from the terrorist list. Why? because they were moving to support Iraq. And in fact, the Reagan administration and in fact the first Bush administration strongly supported Iraq right through its worst, Saddam, right through his worst atrocities. In fact, they succeeded in preventing even criticism of the condemnation of the worst atrocities, like the Halabja massacre and others. So they removed Iraq from the terrorist list because they wanted to support one of the worst monsters and terrorists in the region, namely Saddam Hussein. And since there was an empty position on the terrorist list, they had to fill it, so they added Cuba. Cuba is probably the target of more terrorism than any country in the world, back from the Kennedy years. Right, in fact, just at that time, there had been a rash of major terrorist acts against Cuba. So Cuba was added to the terrorist list to replace Saddam Hussein, who was removed because the U.S. wanted to support him. Now, you take a look through the terrorist list, you know, that's the way it is. So, for example, Hezbollah is on the terrorist list. Well, you know, probably it's carried out terrorist acts, but by the standards of the U.S. and Israel, they're barely visible. The main reason why Hezbollah is on the terrorist list is because it resisted Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, and in fact drove Israel out of southern Lebanon after 22 years of occupation. That's called terrorism. In fact, Lebanon has a national holiday, May 25th, which is called Liberation Day. That's the national holiday in Lebanon, commemorating, celebrating the Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon in the year 2000, largely under Hezbollah attack.
How would you characterize Hezbollah and Hamas? How would you characterize them?
Hezbollah happens to be the major political grouping in Lebanon. It, the Hezbollah-based coalition, handily won the last election in the year 2009. Now, you know, it's not a perfect election, but it's one of the, by the standards of U.S.-backed dictatorships, it was an amazing election, and they won it. They didn't happen to win the largest number of representatives because of the way the confessional system is works, but they won the popular vote by about the same amount that Obama had won. So they're the main political grouping in the country. They largely almost completely control southern Lebanon. They're a national Lebanese organization. They're charged with some terrorist acts outside of Lebanon, maybe correctly. But again, if the charges, we take all the charges and weigh them against U.S.-Israeli violence, aggression, and terror, that they don't even count. But that's basically what they are. As far as Israel's concerned, Hezbollah's position is they don't recognize Israel. But they say their position is, well, they'll accept any agreement with Israel that the Palestinians accept. We're a Lebanese organization. What about Hamas? Hamas is its background is it's an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamist organization, which would be a major competitor in Egypt's elections, if Egypt permitted democratic elections, which it won't. The Egyptian dictatorship, which the U.S. strongly backed, so Obama personally strongly backed, doesn't permit anything remotely like elections and is very brutal and harsh. But they don't. They hate the Muslim Brotherhood, and Hamas is an offshoot. In its early days, Israel supported Hamas as a weapon against the secular PLO. Later, when Hamas really crystallized and became a significant organization, Israel turned against them, and it became bitterly opposed to them in January 2006, as the U.S. did when they won a free election. That was intolerable. They had to be overthrown. Hamas's position is that as a political party, it does not recognize Israel, but that doesn't mean much. The Democratic Party doesn't recognize countries either. It says that their position is that they're willing to accept a two-state settlement in accordance with the international consensus, which the U.S. and Israel have blocked for 35 years. So they say, yes, we'll accept that, but we don't want to recognize Israel. Well, okay, that's their position. Are they a nice organization? No, I certainly wouldn't want to live under their clerical rule. Compared with organizations and states that the United States strongly supports, they don't stand out as particularly harsh. Say Egypt, for example.
So respond to those who defend Israel's policy and state that Israel is surrounded by enemies. Their Arab neighbors, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Palestine, Ahmadinejad in Iran, they pose a threat to Israel. They want to see Israel's destruction, and they feel like these Arab countries are an imminent threat to Israel. Give me your thoughts on those who defend Israel's policies.
Well, the truth of the matter is that Israel and the United States, which act in tandem, are a tremendous threat to the, mainly to the Palestinians. In fact, while we're discussing the potential threat to Israel that might exist, the United States and Israel are crushing and destroying the Palestinians. That's the live reality. Now, what about the threat? Well, yeah, there's a potential threat, and Israel and the United States are substantially responsible for it. I mean, if the U.S. and Israel would accept the overwhelming international consensus on a political settlement, that would very sharply reduce the threat. But Israel and the U.S. prefer Israeli expansion to diplomatic settlement, and therefore are blocking that settlement. They're alone. I mean, Europe, the non-aligned countries, the Arab League, the Organization of Islamic States, which includes Iran, have all accepted the international consensus on the two-state settlement. I mean, there are details to be worked out, but the basic structure is clear. For 35 years, the U.S. and Israel have been blocking it. There are a few rare and temporary exceptions, but that's basically the story. I don't have time to run through all the details here.
But what's
the rationale is very simple.
Exactly.
They prefer expansion to security. That's been explicitly true since 1971. I think the most fateful decision that Israel and the U.S. made in this regard was in February 1971 when President Sadat of Egypt offered Israel a full peace settlement, no conditions, nothing for the Palestinians in return for Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories, and in fact he cared only about Sinai. Jordan made the same proposal a year later with regard to the West Bank. Israel had to decide at that point whether to accept security, which would certainly have followed from the withdrawal from the conflict of the major Arab military forces, primarily Egypt, secondly Jordan, whether to accept security or to insist on expansion. Now, expansion at that time was mostly into the Sinai. Israel was developing plans for substantial expansion into the Egyptian Sinai, including a major city, Yamit, supposedly a million people, a lot of settlements and so on. And that was a very clear choice. Do we choose expansion or security? They chose expansion. The crucial question is, what would the United States do? Well, there was an internal bureaucratic battle in the U.S., and Henry Kissinger won out. He was in favor of what he called stalemate. A stalemate meant no negotiations, just force. So the U.S. and Israel proceeded with expansion. Sadat, he made gesture after move after move for the next year or two to try to convince the U.S. to accept a political settlement. It was disregarded. He kept threatening war if Israel continued to develop the Northeast Sinai. It was dismissed. Then came the October 1973 war, which was a very close thing for Israel, the worst moment in its history. Well, at that point, Kissinger and the Israeli leaders recognized they can't simply dismiss Egypt, and they moved slowly towards the Camp David settlement in 1978, which pretty much accepted what Sadat had offered in 1971, a diplomatic catastrophe. Meanwhile, Israel has continued its expansion by then mostly into the West Bank, and the U.S. was supporting it all the way, and so it continues. So sure, if Israel continues to settle in the occupied territories illegally, incidentally, as Israel recognized in 1967, mm-hmm. It's all illegal. They recognized it. It's undermining the possibilities for the viable existence of any small Palestinian entity. And as long as the United States and Israel continue with that, yes, there'll be insecurity.
This is essentially an issue of land. It's not a religious issue. It's an issue of land and it's economics that's motivating Israel to expand. Is that what you're saying?
Primarily. In fact, the president of Israel, Ezer Weizmann, shortly before he became president, after 1967, pointed out, he was then chief of the Air Force, said, look, we could withdraw from the occupied territories, but then we couldn't live at the scale and style and grandeur that we would prefer. That's not an exact quote, words to approximately that effect. And yeah, that's basically true. The expansion into the West Bank is, you know, it's kind of understandable. I mean, the parts of the West Bank that Israel's taking over are, first of all, a good part of the arable land. The pleasant suburbs of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, which happen to be in the West Bank, the major water resources, which are in the area that Israel's taking over, the Jordan Valley, which is arable land, of course, and essentially imprisons what's left. And then Israel has been sending corridors through the occupied territories. The most important one of several, is east of what's called Jerusalem. Jerusalem is now a vastly expanded area, which Israel has annexed in violation of Security Council orders as well as in violation of international law. And expanding east from there is a corridor started in the 1970s under Yitzhak Rabin. Now includes the town of Ma'ale Adumim, basically bisects the West Bank. There are two other corridors to the north. It breaks up the remaining areas of the West Bank into what Ariel Sharon, the architect of the one of the main architects of the policy, called Bantustans. Sure, as long as they do that, there's going to be continued. It's understandable why they do it. Sure, they want that land and they want the resources. And it does, as Ezer Weizmann said, it allows them to live in a scale and character beyond what would happen if they lived peacefully within their own territories. And the U.S. backs them so they can do it, and is continuing to back them under Obama. So sure, their position is, well, okay, let's just go ahead and do it.
Wait,
that does lead to insecurity, that's a decision they made in 1971.
But, and you've stated that this expansion is dangerous for Israel. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, you already elaborated on it at the beginning when you said that they're facing threats. When you expand into somebody else's territory and you refuse to allow and you destroy the legitimate national aspirations of the indigenous inhabitants, now restricted to about 22% of Palestine, even in the international arrangements. When you do that, sure, you're going to lead insecurity. Remember also that Israel has invaded its northern neighbor, Lebanon, five times, brutally, harshly, plenty of terror, plenty of violence, no credible pretext. I don't have time to go through the details, but I've done so in print. Well, yes, so Lebanon's hostile too. Lebanon is actually a weak state. They can't do much, but that leads to plenty of hostility in the region. With regard to Iran, Iran was a very close ally of Israel as long as it was under the Shah. Ahmadinejad has issued what we call threats against Israel. They're not actually threats. And if you look at the exact wording, he's repeating statements by Khomeini at a time when Israel was pretty close to Iran and didn't care about them. He's saying, yes, in the end of days, Israel should disappear. Okay. Not nice, you know, it does a lot of other rotten things. It's a horrible regime. But to say that it's a threat to Israel is a bit extreme. I mean, in fact, to the extent that there is a potential Iranian threat, it would be, it's claimed that the Iranian nuclear program is a threat. Well, okay, if you believe that, there are clear steps to take. Move towards a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. Now, that would not terminate any potential threat, but it would certainly mitigate it. Nuclear weapons-free zones are a very important step towards reducing the threat of nuclear weapons and of proliferation. And, in fact, the U.S. is committed to that. It agreed to it in 1995 in the Nuclear review conference just last May, a couple of weeks ago, Egypt, which leads the non-aligned movement at the moment, 118 countries, pressed very hard for moving towards establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. The U.S. was pressed into a corner and couldn't disagree, so said, sure, we agree in principle. But Hillary Clinton said, yes, but the time is not ripe. And the U.S., Obama, hid behind the Israeli position, which said, sure, let's do it, but after there's a comprehensive peace settlement, which the U.S. and Israel can delay indefinitely, as they've been doing. So there are no steps towards a nuclear weapons-free zone, to which, incidentally, the United States is very strongly committed. The U.S. and Britain, when they invaded Iraq, tried to provide a kind of a thin legal cover for it. And the legal cover was a Security Council Resolution 687 from 1991, which called on Iraq to eliminate its weapons of mass destruction program. And as you recall, the U.S. and Israel and the U.K. claimed that they had not done so. Well, it turned out to be false, but they claimed they had not done so. But if you look at that resolution, Article 14, it calls on the signers to move to establish a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. So the U.S. and U.K., above everyone else, are committed to this. But it isn't even discussed here. So to talk about the Iranian nuclear threat while we're refusing to take the most elementary steps towards eliminating any potential threat that might arise sometime is kind of ludicrous. In fact, if you look at there is now a declassified study from last April from the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon assessing the military balance in the region, the Iranian threat included in particular. And they point out that Iran's military doctrine is essentially defensive. It's an attempt to deter attacks, that Iran's military expenditures are relatively low compared to the region, and of course minuscule as compared to the U.S., and that if they are developing nuclear weapons, it would be as a deterrent. Mm-hmm. So whatever threat Iran poses is not a military threat. It's a threat of independence. Well, you know, Israel doesn't like that. The U.S. doesn't like that. But to call that a threat, while Israel has a huge nuclear capacity, mm-hmm. has refused to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, mm-hmm. is rejecting calls from the International Atomic Energy Agency to open up its facilities to inspection backed by the U.S., I mean, and is in fact proceeding to crush Palestinians. I mean, anybody watching this from Mars would break down in hysterical laughter.
Well, Israel is the only nation in the Middle East which has nuclear weapons, but it has not officially acknowledged that they have them.
That's correct, and it is one of three nuclear states that have not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Israel, India, and Pakistan, all of which are protected by the United States in their nuclear weapons programs, to which the U.S., in fact, contributes and has contributed. Those are the three non-signers.
And so
that continues to this moment. Uh-huh. I mean, in this context, how can we even listen to Obama saying he wants to get rid of nuclear weapons?
And so, I mean, there's some cynicism I hear in your voice. So, and it's understandable, I would say. But so, what can we expect to happen if there's not going to be the international community is calling on the Middle East to be a nuclear-free zone, and yet Israel and the United States are not moving in that direction? So,
not only not moving in that direction, but blocking it.
So,
and remember that the U.S. has a specific commitment over and above other countries because of the Iraq invasion.
So where do we go from here?
That's up to people like you.
Uh-huh.
We're citizens of the United States. If we care about what our country's doing, we should proceed to do something about it.
So, well, when you say we should proceed to do something, give me some specifics. What should we do?
We should be organizing and acting to get Congress to compel the administration to move towards reducing the dire threat of nuclear weapons. And there are many ways to do it. One is by establishing nuclear weapons-free zones. The Middle East is one case, but it's not the only case. So to mention another relevant here, the African Union did finally agree to a nuclear weapons-free zone, but it can't implement it. And the reason it can't implement it is because of the United States and Britain. There is an island in the Indian Ocean, Diego Garcia, which is claimed by the African Union. It's part of Africa. Britain and the United States, it has bases for U.S. Nuclear weapons and nuclear submarines and so on. The population was kicked out by Britain so that the United States could establish a major military base there. That base is used, it's a major military base, it's used for bombing of Middle East and Central Asia. Obama is beefing it up very sharply. He's both its nuclear weapons capacity and its massive ordnance. In fact, he's just sent there a couple hundred so-called bunker busters, the biggest weapons in the arsenal, short of nuclear weapons, aimed at Iran. All of that's going on right now. Diego Garcia is excluded by the U.S. and Britain from the African Union nuclear weapons-free zone, which means they can't implement it. Well, that's one case. The Middle East is another case. There actually are others. But if we're interested in non-proliferation, we should be compelling the U.S. government to take concrete steps that are available towards reducing the threat of war, for example, dismantling the military base in Diego Garcia and terminating the threats of aggression against Iran, and moving towards reducing and towards mitigating the threat of use of nuclear weapons or development of nuclear weapons, which can be done in many ways, nuclear weapons-free zones being the most obvious.
But this
a lot that we can do.
But this isn't widely covered in the U.S. media.
That's a bit of an understatement. It isn't covered, period.
Mm-hmm.
Try to find some references.
Mm-hmm. So how do American citizens get informed on this issue? It's not covered. Why isn't the media?
By people like you writing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And organizing and educating. That's our job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not tossed in jail for telling the truth about these things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid I've got to take off. I have another interview.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you. Can I ask you one last question?
Yeah.
Okay. As a Jewish American, what would you like to say to other Jewish Americans regarding Israel?
Pretty much what I said in the 1970s. I mean, I wrote at that time, and I think it's even more true today, that those who call themselves supporters of Israel are, in fact, supporters of Israel's moral degeneration, increased isolation, and possible ultimate destruction. I hate to say it, and I hate to see it, but it's coming true.
Okay, on that note, I think it went well. Thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time with me, Professor Chomsky. Have a great afternoon.
Good to talk to you.
Okay, bye-bye.